Hello, this is Sheila Jans, a board member of the Maine Humanities Council. I'd like to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas in Maine.
Yes. That's a great question, and it's an important critical point in analyzing the whole war, because from start to finish, in every aspect of that argument, virtually everything during that period was cast in terms of us versus them, good versus evil, godless communism versus righteous capitalism, free enterprise. The communist doctrine struck at the heart of American beliefs of not only government, but how the economy should work. Part of the answer is a long-standing suspicion among Americans of a strong centralized government. That becomes one of the core arguments throughout the United States history, whether you're talking about the formation of the Articles of Confederation or the events leading up to the Civil War. Communism struck at the core critique of the American economic system. And that, throughout the 1800s, oftentimes was perceived as a threat, whether you're talking about the formation of guilds, labor unions, or whether you're addressing the role of government in American lives. And that brings another critical point in understanding the foundations of the Cold War. You can't look at how the Cold War impacted Americans and how it played a role in political discussions without understanding Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal in the 1930s. An unprecedented expansion in the size of the federal government to fight the Great Depression, but not only to fight the Great Depression, but to, in Franklin Roosevelt's views, do the right thing in order to ameliorate suffering, precipitated a very emotional and controversial debate in American lives. Had a direct impact on Margaret J. Smith and how she'd operated, too. What is the role of government? How centralized should it be? Should it provide old age pensions for America's elderly who were living in abject poverty? Followed by a handful of Francis Townsend thought so in the 1920s and the 1930s. So did Margaret J. Smith's husband, Clyde. As a result of those discussions, we end up with Social Security. But as the Cold War opens, individuals like Clyde Smith and Margaret J. Smith, who supported certain governmental programs, felt themselves open to charges of being pro-communist. Russian Revolution feared communism. Franklin Roosevelt grappling with the Great Depression, expanding the involvement of the federal government in people's lives. A country which becomes entangled and involved with other countries too, in order to deal with post-World War II issues, which leads the United States to take a leadership role in creating something known as the United Nations. Another important piece of that puzzle and sovereignty. And that becomes a critical bone of contention when Joe McCarthy takes hold of the anti-communist persuasion and launches diatribe and attack upon Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman's State Department. Each of those plays a critical role in fueling Cold War rhetoric, which, beginning in 1946, permeates the American political process. Less than a year after the United States is victorious in World War II, political campaigns in this country become colored by politicians who begin to use the pro-communist charge against their opponents. The Cold War happens pretty quickly. It begins very quickly after the end of World War II. We have events occurring in the Middle East over oil. Boy, imagine that, oil. And almost immediately, politicians like Richard Nixon and Joe McCarthy utilize these concerns and fears of the Soviet Union to gain a political advantage and to win election to the United States Congress. Nixon does it in 46 against a guy by the name of Jerry Voorhees. McCarthy uses similar tactics to defeat a longtime giant of Wisconsin politics. And that becomes the frightening norm in elections from 1946 through 1954. Roger K. Smith feels that same wrath. She's elected to Congress in 1940. Serves four terms now as a representative, and in 1948 decides that she wants to pursue statewide office and gain election to the United States Senate. Gives up a safe seat in the United States House of Representatives in order to pursue the United States Senate. One thing you have to remember about Margaret, you get me. No, go ahead. A lot of it had to do with the geopolitical, I'm going to use that term, the situation on the ground at the end of World War II. The Soviet army was astride Eastern Europe. Franklin Roosevelt, the British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and the Soviet leader Joseph Stalin met in the Crimea at a place called Yalta, February 1945. And basically what that agreement stated was that they recognized that the Soviet army is astride Eastern Europe as they are working together to put the finishing touches on Hitler's armies. But basically what was done was a deferring all the decisions regarding how these things would be administered. You can't lose sight of the fact that Western and Eastern Europe were decimated physically, emotionally, economically, to the point that countries like Britain, France, the Netherlands could no longer really administer their own colonial holdings in areas like Africa, the Middle East, French Indochina. You're looking at a significant situation in which the only two games in town are the United States and the Soviet Union. because of their differences and what they see to be the high-stakes game that's going to be played virtually immediately, small differences over administrative issues, whether it's the partition of Germany, become large. Cuba! Can we get to that in a minute? Yeah, I don't believe we talked about that in a little bit. One point I want to make about Margaret Chase Smith as she enters this political atmosphere in which opportunism, the use of charging people as communists, challenging individuals' loyalty to the country. In looking at Margaret Chase Smith, I think it's very important to keep in mind that from the time she ran for office the first time in 1940, for the next 20 years, she did not have the support of the main Republican Party, even though she was a Republican. When she first ran for Congress in 1940, after the death of her husband, the leading name political power was a guy by the name of Ralph Owen Brewster. That name mean anything to you? Anybody ever see the movie The Aviator? Brewster was a guy who actually grew up in Dexter, just a little ways from here. Elected governor of Maine in the mid-1920s with the help of the KKK. Ultimately won election to the United States Senate and was the real power within the main Republican Party until 1952. When Margaret Chase Smith was accompanying her husband's body back from Washington, D.C. to Scott Eaton, Brewster was along for the ride, and it looked like he was comforting the grieving widow, when in fact what he was doing was trying to convince her not to run for Congress. He didn't want Margaret Chase Smith in Washington. And that kind of epitomizes the way the main Republican Party approached Margaret Chase Smith until 1960. When she ran for the Senate in 1948, the head of the main Republican Party circulated smear sheets throughout the state which claimed that Margaret Chase Smith's voting record was pro-communist, that she had broken up her husband's first marriage when she was 13 years old, a whole series of absurd charges. He claimed that she was, her maiden name was actually Chasse instead of Chase, and that she was ashamed of her Franco-American heritage. They even went so far as to claim that she was dying of cancer, so don't bother voting for her. But the most damaging charge was that her voting record reflected her pro-communist leanings, and they connected her, as many other campaigns across the country did, they connected her to a fellow from New York by the name of Vito Marcantonio. And that kind of became the measuring rod for smearing somebody and to try to tag them with the pro-communist label. And it happened to Margaret Chase Smith. And it happened to politicians all across the country. As Americans tried to deal with this whole issue of the Cold War, now there's a lot going on at this time, both domestically and internationally. Margaret Chase Smith is running a campaign for statewide office at a time when tensions internationally are intensifying. And we series of high-profile espionage cases hit the front pages of the newspapers. And some of them were proven cases of espionage. When you combine that with the fact that in September of that year, the Soviet Union detonates an atomic device long before experts thought that they would have that capability, it delivered a real body blow to the American people. And what happens a month later? Communist Chinese, the victorious in their civil war. How could that happen? And of an espionage. And in January of 1950, a fellow by the name of Alger Hiss is convicted of perjury on espionage charges. The statute of limitations on the espionage charges had run out. But when Alger Hiss is convicted of perjury on charges that he gave atomic secrets to the Soviet Union, that was a game changer. Franklin Roosevelt's critics had said that Roosevelt immorally had given the farm away and sacrificed people of Eastern Europe to the Soviets, to the ruthless communists. And Alger Hiss was there at the creation of the United Nations. And critics of the Democratic administration started saying, well, there might be something to this pro-communist rhetoric. January 1950 starts a critical 6-month timeline. When Hiss is convicted, it's a week after Truman, Secretary of State, the dreaded State Department. Dean Acheson gives a major address in which he talks about defense and the Asian fear. Seemingly dull address, but it ultimately comes back to haunt him. Critics begin to focus on the State Department and its role in undermining, in their opinion, the United States in the Cold War. February 9th, 1950. Senator from Wisconsin by the name of Joe McCarthy is talking to a group called the Ohio County Republican Women's Club of Wheeling, West Virginia. And he states, and he held in his hand the names of 205 State Department employees who were known communists or who were working to undermine the United States' national security. Started in motion a series of investigations and charges and countercharges which intensified the Cold War. And McCarthy used his perch in the United States Senate to attack individual after individual and leveled ultimately baseless charges against them. Versus them, Republican versus Democrat issue. It began to only serve to Senate, accusing them of being known communists, and each one was fully exonerated. Which didn't sit well with Mark G. Smith. She looked at the evidence, she listened to the hearings. And on Memorial Day weekend, 1950, she sat in her living room and wrote what became known as a Declaration of Conscience speech. That's a good question. I'm not sure part of the affiliation. Two of them were college professors. One was a State Department liaison, a woman. One was an author who 20 years before had written a book critical of United States ally in China, Chiang Kai-shek. One was a State Department, a professor who was an advisor to the State Department. It was unquestionably any tenuous connection McCarthy could make to the State Department. Great question. Yeah. They are executed in the summer of 1953. But those investigations are going on at this time. It's a great point. It's not just the McCarthys who are looking into this stuff, the Nixons, the Joe McCarthys. And that's a critical point to keep in mind when you're looking at this. Barbara J. Smith gives her Declaration of Conscience speech in 1950, June. Joe McCarthy, for all intents and purposes, was all done after that speech. He runs the anti-communist crusade from 1915 to 1954. That contradicts what I just said. She gives an address which a presidential advisor by the name of Bernard Baruch says if a man had given that speech, he'd be the next president of the United States. McCarthy has lost all credibility after that talk. Unfortunately, 3 weeks later, communist North Korea crosses the 38th parallel and invades South Korea, starting the Korean War. And again, it comes back to the State Department. And because that Dean Acheson talk I alluded to in January of 1950, Acheson basically said the United States had drawn a defense perimeter. It was a haphazard thing to do, but it left Korea out. So when communist North Korean soldiers and communist Chinese start shooting at American soldiers, McCarthy gains renewed life. Once again, takes control over the anti-communist crusade. And for the next 4 years, he embarks on a running campaign to try to discredit Barbara J. Smith, to kick her off committees, to do whatever he can, whether it's just being like a chihuahua nipping at her ankles, to influencing some tabloid journalists to smear her. The Korean War changed American approach to the communist threat. Because now you know you not only have Joe McCarthy, supporters, but you have mainstream American politicians across political lines doing things like introducing legislation to outlaw the Communist Party in this country. Our impeachment introduced, the Senate bill to do that. In 1953, as did 20 other major politicians, and not just McCarthy supporters, people from the liberal side of the political spectrum, Hubert Humphrey from Minnesota, the individual who becomes the head of the most liberal Supreme Court in the nation's history, Earl Warren, introduced legislation not while the Communist Party as governor of California. Politicians across the spectrum in the early 1950s sought to demonstrate their anti-communist credentials. And this gets at that whole issue of pervasive fear. Things bundled because they all interconnect. 1951, Congress passes and ratifies the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution. Anybody know what that is? It limits the president's tenure to 2 terms in office. Franklin Roosevelt, who served 4 terms, was elected 4 times. The following year, legislation is introduced into Congress to insert the words "under God" into the Pledge of Allegiance. If you said the Pledge of Allegiance before 1954, you did not say "under God." Legislation making communism an act of sedition. Each of these seemingly innocuous acts or episodes added up the big picture in which the Cold War drove American policy in this country, whether it was educational policy, military, or even terrorism. Saw this as an act of naked aggression against the United States ally. You know, Germany's partitioned after World War II. South Korea was also. And the United States, under Truman, just felt they could not sit back and allow that to happen. It was done under the auspices of the Korea and the United Nations. But the United States was the prime defender of South Korea. Yes.
Would you say that it was more
That's a very, very good question. I would say that most Americans didn't fully understand what a communist system would look like, but they were very much affected by the planned economies that led to World War II, whether it was Mussolini's Italy, it was Germany, and certainly the repeated 5-year plans under Stalin and the Soviet Union. That whole concept planned economy, centralized government, controlling every aspect of a nation's heartbeat, played an incredibly important role in debates after World War II. Critics saw that Roosevelt's New Deal continued on intact. And there were arguments and discussions during the 1950s. Are education has supported them, that don't, that the size of the federal government could be pulled back, not everything would be returned to pre-Great Depression days. But former President Herbert Hoover headed something called the Hoover Commission, in which they sought to reorganize the federal government and make it smaller. And part of that was driven by this almost innate concern Americans had with growth in the size of the federal government, tied to the experiences in the 1930s. Diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union after 1933. And you had a period of lessening of tensions and cultural exchanges between the United States, cultural organizations in this country, and also in the Soviet Union. Some were simply just that, cultural exchanges. Others became communist front organizations. But ultimately, what that resulted in was the opportunity for people on seats like the House American Activities Committee to challenge individuals' loyalty during the height of the McCarthy period. Margaret K. Smith starts to play a more mainstream role in the Cold War after 1952. The campaign for the presidency in the Republican Party in 1952 was probably the bloodiest in its history. There was a significant debate between the leading contenders for the presidential nomination. Again, centering on what should be the role of America in the world. It created a tremendous schism within that party. Ultimately, Republicans opted for Dwight Eisenhower. But there had been a move, a push to put a woman on the vice presidential slot. And that was driven by the National Business and Professional Women's Organization. They wanted a woman on both Democrat and the Republican ticket. And they wanted Margaret K. Smith to be the Republican choice. But that would have meant that the powers that be would have to endorse her Declaration of Conscience speech against Joe McCarthy. And they weren't willing to do that. Consequently, when she was here in this house caring for her dying mother, politicians at the GOP convention had a congresswoman mount the podium and say that Margaret K. Smith had asked that her name be withdrawn from nomination. It didn't happen that way, but that again is indicative of the controversy surrounding Joe McCarthy, the price Margaret K. Smith paid for challenging McCarthy and standing up for principle. And it reflected the tremendous tensions within the country. Two years later, she is up for re-election. And Joe McCarthy encourages the Republican to challenge her in the primary, which Robert Jones did. Despite the fact that Margaret K. Smith won decisively, it was another example in which the National and the main Republican Party did not support her at this time. One of those critical years in which Americans faced changes events which change the country. Occasionally you see a book come out, 1933, Characters in Crisis, or David Morales wrote a great book on 1968. I think few historians write a book on 1954. The country gets a polio vaccine. The French get trashed. The Indian food. Joe McCarthy challenges the army in the televised hearings. An event after an event, Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka. Smith defeats a McCarthy-sponsored candidate in the primary and goes on to an election. By the end of the year, the United States Senate dealt McCarthy the most serious punishment you can do, short of kicking him out of the body. Within 3 years, he moved Trump himself to death at the age of 48. But the impact of McCarthy continued on. Could have been expelled, but they held it to that. Margaret J. Smith at the time was traveling internationally and cut short her organized world trip in order to come back and cast her vote against McCarthy. Her role in the 1950s in many ways can help illuminate the changing approach the United States had from a policy standpoint. She gets appointed to the Senate Armed Services Committee. And from that perch, she begins to support United States efforts in Korea in changing the country's approach to military policy and takes a leadership role in making sure that the United States military has the capability to respond to a changing and increasingly diverse threat as she saw it. In looking at Margaret J. Smith's career and impact, there's no question that she reflected mainstream bipartisan concerns during the Cold War, despite the fact that she gained a national reputation for challenging Joe McCarthy. That was just a small part of her picture. The Declaration of Conscience speech itself, historians give very fleeting, lasting historical significance because it did not stop Joe McCarthy. When she delivered that speech, people on both sides of the aisle praised her for it because they saw an important call to reason. But she didn't stick around and enjoy the accolades. She immediately traveled to Florence, Italy to take part in a United Nations conference, opening herself up to more target practice from Joe McCarthy and support by being such an open supporter of the United Nations. And when she got to that conference, who was her escort? By the name of Esther Brunauer, who was one of those seven people Joe McCarthy had targeted in that period from February through May of 1950, again opening herself up. Fortunately for Margaret J. Smith, the old guard Republican leadership begins to fade away, beginning in 1952 with the defeat of Dexter's Ralph Owen Brewster. Yes. And a very good relationship. Until the early 1970s. And nothing happened between the two of them, but she had met on a Far Eastern trip. They were good friends. You can find personal paintings that Madame Chang had done here. In the early 1970s, policy towards Mao's communist China changed, and Mao's China was invited to join the United Nations secured a seat on the Security Council, and Chang's Taiwan was booted out. That, in a lot of ways, put Madame Chang into a state of seclusion. And after that, Margaret J. Smith's, their relationship kind of petered out to the annual Christmas card exchange, and they didn't have a lot of contact after that. During this period, the political stakes were pretty high in this country. The breakdown in the United States Senate was incredibly close. And in the 83rd Congress, looking at 1953 to 1955, they had a remarkable series of events in which nine sitting United States senators died in a short period of time. And one other resigned. And each time someone died, it changed control of the Senate. That's an important point to keep in mind, because that raised the stakes and helped fuel the Cold War rhetoric that we saw in so many different political campaigns. And it created a situation in which one of Margaret Chase Smith's classmates, if you'll call him that, elected in 1948, and that includes people like Hubert Humphrey, future President Lyndon Johnson, a number of major senators, Estes P. Fowler, Paul Douglas, who was a well-respected senator from Illinois, but he grew up in Newport, went to Bowdoin College. A remarkable group of individuals. This dynamic and everything we've been talking about regarding the Cold War and the high stakes and the emotionalism and the fear, whether it's something that drives the changes in the Pledge of Allegiance or the 22nd Amendment or that leads Margaret J. Smith and Earl Warren each to introduce legislation to outlaw the Communist Party. This situation only heightened that. And in June of 1954, one of the members of her class, a fellow by the name of Lester Hunt of Wyoming, had been pressured to give up his seat and not run for re-election for a second time in that 54 election. And they threatened him. Exposed the activities of his son to the point that it led Lester Hunt to sneak a rifle under his coat into a Senate office and kill himself. That had a significant effect on Margaret Chase Smith, and that affected others. And you begin to see, after that year, 1954 becomes a changing point. McCarthy gets censured. Changes within the Republican Party at the top, some of them driven by some of the key people in here who are dead now. Robert Taft, a senator from Ohio, very much one of these people who opposed U.S. involvement in the United Nations. Taft, one of the other leading Republicans of the time, New York Governor Thomas Dewey, hated each other. Dewey characterized Taft as one of these guys who considered foreign countries to be a place where there's terrible plumbing and funny colored money. That change in Republican leadership helped bring about the end of what one individual has called the mortician's wing of the Republican Party. And you see a lessening of this Cold War rhetoric for the remainder of the 1950s. Despite the fact that individual situations are heightening, whether it's in Indochina or Cuba, the rhetoric on the American political front begins to tone down. And that's despite the creation of organizations like the John Birch Society. As that situation improves, Margaret Chase Smith's relations with the Republican Party, both in Maine and in the nation, begins to improve. And that's indicative and reflective of the diminished influence of what I call the oil poisoners. There's a lot going on in the country in these years. And it's not all directly connected to the Cold War. Americans' views on a wide range of things are challenged and expanded, whether it's the growth of fast food, demographic changes, which after 1954 have Major League Baseball team playing west of Mississippi, but there's still a constant Cold War component to it, because the creation of the interstate highway system mid-decade very much driven by Cold War concerns. And Margaret J. Smith is at the heart of these debates.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.